From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. The Finger Lakes wine industry earned a big victory earlier this month. It was announced that the 2015 Wine Bloggers Conference will be held in the Finger Lakes. In the wine world, that's a big deal. Most of the past conferences have been on the West Coast, held in well-known wine regions or regions with large marketing budgets and hotel and infrastructure space. The conference includes 3 days of meetings and seminars. Its main purpose is to bring writers together from around the world to learn from one another. But over the years, there's become another purpose for the Wine Bloggers Conference. The writers gather in a wine region they want to learn more about. And it's become a chance to visit some of the wineries there. It's kind of an educational tour de force, a big opportunity for a region, especially those with smaller marketing budgets. So while Napa Valley was an obvious choice for past conferences, this group is now looking to expand its wine horizons. This news will make an impact for a wine region that is trying to establish its reputation. Our first guest this hour is Morgan McLaughlin. She's the past president of Finger Lakes Wine Country. That's a regional trade and marketing organization. She's the current executive director of Santa Barbara Vintners in Southern California. Now, the 2014 Wine Bloggers Conference just wrapped up in Santa Barbara, and now it's heading for the Finger Lakes next year. Morgan, you're someone very well positioned to understand the meaning of this conference coming to the Finger Lakes, because you were in the Finger Lakes for a number of years before going to Santa Barbara. The conference just wrapped in Santa Barbara. What does it mean for a region to bring this kind of conference in?
Well, it's absolutely an honor to host one of the conferences. The conference happens once a year, and it's a pretty tough selection process in terms of your application. But first and foremost, you have to be a wine region that has a solid international reputation, and it's exciting that the Finger Lakes has been recognized.
You are here, and when you were with the Finger Lakes before you went to Santa Barbara, was the Finger Lakes ever in the running under your leadership to get this conference?
Yes, we had identified the Bloggers Conference as something that the Finger Lakes would want, and so we applied actually in 2010 when the conference had identified the need to move to the East Coast at least every other year. But unfortunately, we lost to Virginia, which, you know, at the time we were disappointed. But for those who may know wine marketing, Virginia is very well funded, and they had the support from state government.
You're implying that this region has less support from state government. The numbers just essentially back that up, don't they?
Well, in 2010, that was absolutely the case. The New York Wine and Grape Foundation, you know, had lost a lot of funding, and compared to other states, New York was, you know, pretty much an embarrassment in terms of wine marketing. I think now with Cuomo and what he's doing with craft beverages, I think it's a different game these days.
Okay, so how many different writers, and give me a sense for not only how many writers, but where they're coming from for the Wine Bloggers Conference?
Well, I think the demographics will be different in New York. For us, we had about 50% of the attendees from California, and then the rest were coming in from other parts of the country, and there was also some international writers as well. I would think next year there'd be more of a skewing for East Coast. I know there was a lot of chatter from writers from D.C., Chicago, who are really excited to come to New York.
How many total? Do you know a rough outline of how many writers came this year?
Well, I think it's hard to be very specific. We had 356 attendees, but not every attendee is an actual blogger slash writer. So I think the number was probably around 250. With 100 being industry, meaning a winery or a PR agency. So I would expect Finger Lakes to have about 200. I think they're capping next year's attendance at 300.
Next month on this program, we're going to be having a Finger Lakes wine roundtable with some of the leading players in the industry here talking about business issues, marketing, success, reaching new markets, etc. And I think this is part of that conversation, which indicates that writers are more in touch with what's happening here. When you started with Finger Lakes Wine Country, what was the reception you got from writers around the state and around the country about the Finger Lakes wine region?
Well, I had a specific story that I tell very often, and that's the first time I had a desk side appointment with a major editor was in New York City, and it was our editor with Town and Country Wedding, and we were pitching why Finger Lakes is an interesting wedding destination, and the editor who was sitting across from me said, why in the world would any of our readers, who are upscale and affluent, why would they want to come to the Finger Lakes to have a wedding when your wines are crap? And that set us off on a path to make sure that we're communicating that the Finger Lakes is not only a great travel destination, but it is a producer of world-class wines.
What year was that conversation?
That was right when I started, so that was 2007.
Yeah, which is not that long ago, and I should let our listeners know that when Morgan McLaughlin went to Santa Barbara and left the Finger Lakes, it was a tough loss for the region because Morgan was tireless in promoting, and not only promoting, I should say, but finding a way to get writers to take a fresh look at the region. When you started, obviously that conversation is one thing, but let's look at big publications. Let's look at the New York Times and the Wine Spectators of the world. When you would call them, would they give you similar reactions that were sort of derisive or dismissive of the wine industry, or was it simply that they were not in touch with what was going on here?
I think it was a combination of both. I mean, I just told you the story of Town and Country. I mean, our next appointment was with Mitch Frank over at Wine Spectators. You know, both offices are in New York City. You know, we met with Mitch, and, you know, I had a simple question for him, and that was, how does the Finger Lakes get on the cover of the magazine? You know, kind of a lofty, almost tongue-in-cheek request. But, you know, he said, Morgan, your problem is that the region is not submitting its wine. You know, they're not playing the game or doing the process that other competing wine regions are doing. And so that set us back. Didn't set us back. It took us back to conversations that, you know, we needed to be organized as individual wineries and as a region, and wines would need to be submitted to the major critics in order to be taken seriously. And success doesn't happen overnight, and it took, you know, a couple vintages of submissions. But then, you know, the door started to open. Wine and Spirits took the lead, I think, in terms of recognizing the potential of the Finger Lakes. And you know, James Moldworth has been, you know, very positive, and now Eisenhoff, and then you have someone like yourself that starts to get involved, and before you know it, it's a kind of a snowball effect.
And now with the Wine Bloggers Conference, there are going to be writers and bloggers who will be here for the first time. What kind of opportunity do you view that? Obviously, you're not with the organization here now, but there are people from the wine industry, from the tourism industry, et cetera. What kind of opportunity is that? And if that weekend next year goes well, what's the potential impact?
The potential impact is significant. I do kind of preface all of my comments that the Wine Bloggers Conference, like any major event, it's a little bit like the Olympics. You need to be realistic in your expectations. It's a three-day event. It's not something that's going to take you from A to Z overnight, but it's another tool in the toolbox, you know, for a region to help gain more media relations and to just be more visible in the industry.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you have more people who write about wine who are aware and respect your product and have been there and have more of a connection to your region, they're more likely to occasionally include it in columns and recommendations. Those wines end up on more wine lists, et cetera. Is that the slow drumbeat of buzz that makes a region? Nobody really knows how to go viral or how to make a region a cult region in the wine world, but do you think it's that slow drumbeat of collective buzz, Morgan, more than just one good score in a magazine, that kind of a thing?
Oh, yes. And you know, Evan, that the wine world is increasingly competitive. You know, nowadays to have wines that score 90+, I mean, that's not enough. I mean, there's a lot of great, well-made wines around the world that are priced well, that have interesting stories, that are from beautiful places. And so, you know, it's important that our stories be told. And, you know, for anyone who's read your book, the biggest connection that someone can make to a wine region is with the people themselves. And, you know, I think that's why having the conference in the Finger Lakes, where writers are coming to the area, they're touching the soil, they're meeting the people, I mean, that's a memory that will last forever.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But on that point, and again, I should preface, we're talking to Morgan McLaughlin, who is now in Santa Barbara wine country, but the former head of the operation in the Finger Lakes industry. And so she has a great perspective on this upcoming Wine Bloggers Conference that just announced that the next year's conference, 2015, will be in the Finger Lakes. I say will be in the Finger Lakes, but it's Corning. And some people will wonder why not Ithaca, which is on Cayuga Lake and closer to the wine country, et cetera, or somewhere else, Watkins Glen, that's now got a big harbor hotel there. Is Corning going to be a kind of barrier and a problem in any way, Morgan?
Well, I think what people don't understand is that the conference is a for-profit conference run by a travel company called Zephyr Adventures. I think this past year in Santa Barbara, it was the 8th conference. So these guys have a very specific set of requirements. So it's not like other media events where the region calls all the shots. You have to have meeting space, infrastructure. You need to have rooms at certain price points. So it's very specific, and unfortunately, or fortunately, there aren't any other areas in the Finger Lakes other than Rochester, and I think it was pretty universal that Rochester wasn't necessarily the best location. So Corning, you know, was the only place that had the price points, the infrastructure to host it. Back in 2010, we had looked at the Stadler because we thought it would be very important to bring in Cornell. And just the young university feel that Ithaca has. But unfortunately, there are barriers, room price and just infrastructure. So I think Corning is a good place to have it. It is the gateway. And the conference is set up as such that most of the programming is at the hotel. So there's really only one day, and it's not a whole day, it's only 3 or 4 hours that the bloggers are getting out into the vineyards. So I've already talked to Lori Poland, my replacement, and Paul Thomas. They both came out. Paul Thomas is from the Seneca Lake Wine Trail. The excursions are going to be amazing. So I don't think you have to worry about it being in Corning.
And let me wrap up with this. You spent so much time for a number of years helping grow the reputation of this region. What's one thing that continues to hold the region back that could be fixed? And I don't know if that's internally, if that's some of the habits internally or some of the attitude internally or not, but what's one barrier that could come down that would help this region?
I think it's just the slow awareness of the wine world at large. The Finger Lakes is an interesting mix of old school producers, grape growers that got into the wine business, you know, to survive. And you've got an interesting mix of new producers. Overall, I think we're undercapitalized as a region. We don't have significant outside investors. You know, Santa Barbara, we have, you know, millions and millions of dollars that are put toward building, development, market expansion. And you just don't see that in the Finger Lakes. So I think over time, you're going to see more outside investment, which I don't think you'll lose the local character. I think it'll just help propel the region to new levels.
That's Morgan McLaughlin of Santa Barbara Vintners in California. Registration's already underway for the 2015 conference, and if the organizers are successful, they'll fill it out with upward of 300 writers. Now, some of those writers write for small blogs or publications you've never heard of, but others write for large newspapers or magazines and have huge followings in their own right. We turn now to another specialty beverage. This Sunday, the Little Theater is showing a documentary called A Film About Coffee. The idea behind the film is to gain an understanding of specialty coffee in every step of the process. Here's a sample from the film's trailer.
Mornings like today, I just did not want to get out of bed. And I think like, oh, but I can go have coffee. And it's like, that thought never gets old.
You know, where does the connoisseurship end and the, oh God, I just want a cup of coffee right now. Where does that begin? Coffee is just symbolically, you know, think about taking 5 seconds and going out of a tap versus coffee being a process that you get to watch and participate in and then somebody hands it to you and it tends to be more beautiful.
There's so much about coffee that we don't understand. The coffee that we're able to get is better than it was 5 years ago.
There's a desire for a more luxurious and delicious experience. It's coffee.
Part of the problem with radio is that you can't see the trailer, and there is plenty to see. And part of that comes from the camera shots high in the mountains as the filmmakers visited coffee growers around the world. We're talking about some remote places and some rather poor farmers who probably never thought they'd have the world's attention. My next guest is John Ebel, the owner of Pour Coffee in Rochester. His business is brand new, and it's part of a growing movement that focuses on not just high-quality coffee, but a relationship with these small growers and farmers around the world. We've talked about the concept on this show before. It's known as Third Wave Coffee. This film is a kind of call to arms for those in the movement. John Ebel and his colleagues at Jobin Coffee and Fuego Coffee are sponsoring its showing in Rochester. John, when were you first aware that this film was being made?
Probably just following the blogs and things. I saw an article about it 3 months ago or so.
What was your first plan in terms of bringing it to Rochester? I mean, did you have to see it first, or are you hearing good things? Give me a sense for that.
Yeah, so the plan originally was, how do I see it? So I looked for cities that were close enough by that were showing it, and realized that Ottawa, Canada, was about as close as I could get to it. So tried to dig in to see what it would be like to bring it here to Rochester. And, you know, found out all the specifics and got the pricing and theater rental costs all together, and then basically bought the rights to show it for one night.
So it's going to show on Sunday at, is it 6:30? When is it showing on Sunday?
Yeah, the doors are opening at 6, and the screening begins at 6:30.
This is going to be the lamest question of the interview, but are you serving coffee during or after?
We are not. Actually, there's some theater restrictions, so we're not. But what we are going to do is go to a bar nearby, and we're going to have some brew stations set up to do coffee. So we haven't figured that out exactly yet. I think it might be Matthews, but we're trying to figure out the last details on that.
So for people who are thinking about coming out to see the film, give us a sense for what you know the film to be about.
Sure. So basically, the creator, the filmmaker, his name is Brandon Roper, and his whole thing is basically an ode to specialty coffee. He wanted to kind of tip his hat to this fad. Actually, it's not really a fad anymore. 25% of the market is specialty coffee now. And there's two different grades of coffee, commodity grade and specialty grade. And it's basically a rating scale. So this is on specialty grade. And specialty focus on the higher level of coffee taste. But it's not really just an educational film. There's a big human element to it as well. So it connects the watchers to the growers of the coffee, and from start to finish to you drink that cup of coffee.
What do you think the pull has been in the direction of growers, of understanding where the coffee comes from? I mean, let's face it, most people wake up, and we've talked about it on the show a few months back, most people wake up and they still want some kind of caffeine delivery system, but obviously the market is shifting. What do you think is the genesis for this interest in growers to begin with?
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I mean, you think about a film about coffee and you almost have this jolt like, well, I drink coffee every day. It's become such a commodity that we don't really think about where it comes from. But on the other hand, there's just such a great love for it. People, I mean, genuinely, they got to have a cup of coffee in the morning. So I think just connecting your sip of coffee to that grower that this film focused on two in particular, one in Rwanda and one in Honduras. And there's actually a scene in the film where one of the growers in Honduras had never actually tasted a sip of his own espresso that he's been growing for 20, 30 years. So they actually, you know, brought an espresso machine there and brewed it up for him, and he tasted it. It was just kind of an emotional scene in the film where, you know, this guy had never tasted his own coffee. And he was, of course, he knew it was good, and the barista that served him said, "This is good coffee." And he's like, "Yeah, no, it's kind of it connects you back to how this begins and where it starts." And it's funny that some of the best coffee in the world comes from some of the poorest nations in the world. So,
what a great point. And I go back to Murray Carpenter's book where he wrote about going to South America. And mm-hmm. even in Colombia, he figured if you go to the hills where the coffee is grown,
right.
it would be this remarkable experience. But what he found was what many of the poor locals were drinking was sort of the what was left that people didn't really want, the worst beans, the, you know, the less choice. The best stuff was getting exported. And it reminds you that there is, I don't know how to articulate other than there's a strange economic disparity there when you see it's sort of a specialty product, and yet the people growing it often don't even get the chance to taste their own stuff.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So what's
that? It focuses on the growers, and it also, you know, it brings it to some certain shops in the world, in Tokyo, New York, and San Francisco, where people are consuming the beans. And it's just from start to finish, it kind of gives you a great look into the world of specialty coffee.
If you're, my guest, by the way, is John Ebel, who owns Pour Coffee just off of Park Avenue in Rochester. What's the street that it's on, John?
It's called Somerton Street. The address is 23 Somerton.
Okay, and it's been open for how long?
3 months we're coming up on now.
So for you, do you expect that in the future you'll be taking trips to these kind of regions?
It's absolutely on our agenda. Yeah, we just bought a roaster. And one of the first things we're going to do is acquire some direct trade relationships, so actually meet some farmers and people in different areas of the world that grow. Probably focus on Central America first and then go from there. But, yeah, that's absolutely kind of we love sitting across the countertop from a customer ordering a coffee. But we also love that human aspect to it of knowing the people that grew it and making sure they get, you know, the money that they're owed for a good product.
How much of your clientele do you think would want to know more about the growers and would have a conversation about the growers?
I think, like, again, going back to connecting it to that human element, when you are sitting across the countertop as a barista giving someone a cup of coffee and you're able to explain kind of the taste in there and where it came from, there seems to be this kind of contagious knowledge that grows between you and the person sitting across the counter. So I think, you know, as for our shop, I can speak from at least, is we try to bring up that in conversation and then, you know, that interest is sparked. So I would hope that 90% plus of our customers would be interested in something like this. And it's just a great film to kind of encapsulate that within, I think it's an hour and 15-minute film.
And for our listeners who might think, well, it sounds like these growers are being taken advantage of, in fact, it's really rather the opposite when it comes to the specialty coffee movement. From what I'm reading, maybe the trends, I don't know who gets the credit for starting it, but the Stumptowns, the Intelligentsias,
sure.
And by the way, you can buy Intelligentsia coffee at Pour. I've seen it there. But they have indicated that they are paying these growers more than they were when they were sort of selling off their coffee in bulk. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said before, there's a difference between a commodity-grade coffee and specialty-grade coffee. And with commodity-grade coffee, on average, there's 10 to 15 different steps in the process. There's growers and co-ops, shipping companies, commodity traders. There's all these different hands that are basically touching the coffee in between that. So the specialty coffee scene essentially is saying, you know, I want to remove some of those middlemen, and I want to go straight to the source, and I'll control how it's shipped. So there's still, you know, a few hands that's touched, but you know, when you take steps out of the process, more money is going to go to that grower ultimately, and you can also kind of control the quality better because you'll get it there quicker.
Do you expect, John, that if your trips to South America and wherever else you end up going, if they go well, is it possible that you'll establish relationships with growers that last years?
Yes, that's the intent. Yep, I actually know the names and that their kids' names. Actually, that's one of the things we're doing with this film in particular, is any proceeds that are gained on ticket sales for a film about coffee will go to an organization called Coffee Kids, and it's specifically there to benefit children of coffee growers that are growing up in that agricultural scene.
John, what drew you to the coffee scene? What's your background before coffee, and what brought you to this scene?
Yeah, it started just loving coffee like most people, and kind of grew from there. I saw someone do a siphon brewing method, which is kind of like a vacuum, looks like a crazy lab experiment, and it was just intriguing to me, the aspect of science and a good taste. in coffee. So I bought one of those and figured out how to do it. And one thing led to the next. Started hearing more about specialty coffee shops and hand brewing methods. And it's a little slower than your drip pot at home, but it makes a really good cup of coffee. So it kind of grew from there, and it's become a real passion.
What is the best coffee shop you've ever been in?
Let's see. I went to Handsome Coffee Roast. It's actually been acquired by Blue Bottle now, but it was just a great experience. They had great tasting coffee. The baristas were friendly. You know, sometimes you go in that shop and you kind of get a scowl if you order the wrong thing. And that really stood out to me as good customer service, good coffee, nice atmosphere. So I would say that was probably the most favorite experience that I've had in a shop.
When I saw that a film about coffee was coming to the Little Theater, I saw some comments online, and inevitably there are people who say, what really is the difference between this method or that method, or this bean or that bean? Isn't it all the same? And I think you're a good person to answer some of those questions. So just sort of briefly, as we kind of look at it, I want to start with the beans.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think makes better beans? What makes one set of beans better than another?
Yeah, so soil is important from the start. You got to know where the coffee is being grown. We probably couldn't grow a very good coffee plant here in upstate New York, but you know, you have areas of the world like, you know, Honduras and Rwanda that are highlighted in this film that the soil is prime for that. Then you go from freshness. So the green beans will get shipped to whoever's roasting. You roast that coffee bean, and it's best to have those beans consumed within 2 weeks. Some argue with that, how long it should be, but around 2 weeks after roast. So, and then, you know, the temperature of the water comes into play. If your water's too hot, it'll burn that the flavor of the bean. And so, you know, at our shop, and I know also at Fuego and Joe Bean Roasters, who are also sponsoring this film, they measure the temperature and weight of the coffee bean, and that, you know, affects things. And I think when you side-by-side taste coffee brewed different ways, you can really taste those differences come through.
What about when it comes to methods? You know, there are inevitably people who think the pour over, the slow stuff, are you possibly actually getting a different product than you would any other way? Or let me actually take it another way. Some people will say, I've got a Keurig at home. What's the difference?
Yeah, the freshness is the biggest thing. It's, you know, vacuum packed. The Keurig is pre-ground in the pot. And those, I mean, it's a great quick, I'm not going to hate on any other brewing method, but you know, you get a different level of freshness when you roast that bean and then consume it within a week or two, grind it right there, have the right temperature of water poured through it. And yeah, you can taste the difference. I'd love to do a taste test with anyone that has a question about that. So.
Have you seen that, by the way? Have you seen people come in and they have not had specialty coffee the way you do it or the care that goes into it? And have you seen minds change? Give me a sense for what that's been like.
Yeah, the biggest thing with the mind thing is I think there's kind of a snootiness that is known with the specialty coffee scene, and that's one of the goals of our shop is to kind of remove that barrier and say, you know, we're just people like anyone else, and yes, we're nerding out on coffee here, but we do it for reasons, and these are the reasons. If you have questions, that's cool. If you don't, and you just want your cup of coffee and leave, that's cool too, but like, we love to talk about it. It's something that we have spent a lot of time researching and learning about, talking to other people, and kind of learning how this craft is, so... We've absolutely seen people come in and begin that process kind of with a skeptical eyebrow raise, like, is this just kind of BS here? Are you guys really doing something? And, you know, you finally get across some of those barriers, and it's like, man, there's something to this. So,
I was in Fuego when a customer came in, and she said that she usually stops Tim Hortons. And again, we're not hating on Tim Hortons or anybody
right.
else. She's just telling a story. And she said she was on her way down to the market and a friend had told her to stop in at Fuego. Mm-hmm. And she clearly had not had a lot of the products that, or at least made in the way that Pour and Fuego and Founders and Joe Bean do it. And so they gave her a taste and she said, wow, that is really intense. And then she said,
yeah.
Is this what real coffee tastes like?
Yeah.
What do you make of that question, John?
That is, I mean, if someone's asking that, they're finding the difference. And that's the best thing. When I see somebody in that kind of aha moment in our shop, that's like one of the reasons we're doing this is to kind of get people exposed to a better way of doing things. And, you know, especially with coffee, it's something people do every day and they've done for years and years of their life. And when you're able to kind of say, here's a another doorway into what could be with coffee. It's a really neat moment, and I'm sure Tony enjoyed that over at Fuego when that happened.
I think he did, yeah. A couple more minutes with John Ebel here. John, real briefly, some people do think that the so-called third wave of the coffee movement compares very closely with people who care about locavore movement where food is grown, wine movement, etc. Do you think coffee lines up with those other agricultural movements?
Very much, yeah, especially with wine. You have your wine drinkers that are content to have wine from a box, but then you have wine tasters and people that know wine to another level, and I think it can be very closely associated with wine and other agricultural and food kind of streams there. So, yeah, I absolutely do. There's varying levels, and going back to, again, commodity grade versus specialty grade, these are people that are tasting the differences between coffee and saying, you know, this tastes better, and there's reasons why. Maybe it was a rainier season, or the soil was different this year, and you can grade the coffee in the same way you'd have a rating on a bottle of wine that you go to your liquor store and find it.
I read a book called God in a Cup, which is about about the movement, and I'm curious to know if you would send people who want to learn more about the movement. There's going to be the film, and we'll get back to that film in just a second, but any other reading materials that you would send people to that, not for homework, but for the fun of it, for learning about coffee?
Yeah, there's another book called Everything But Espresso, and that's God in a Cup's a great book as well. It's like I said, it's now consumed 25% of the overall coffee consumption in the United States, so specialty coffee is not a fad. It's huge, especially when you line it up with your grocery store coffee you can walk into and buy off the shelf. It's a large market, so there's reading materials online, and there's blogs, and there's great shops like you talked about, Intelligentsia and Stumptown and Verve Coffee Roasters. These are all people that write about this and give instructional videos how to do things. Or you can go to your local shops, like you mentioned, Founders and Fuego, Joe Beam and Pour at our shop here. So there's lots of educational resources out there. But, yeah, those are two great books.
What are you drinking most of these days?
Let's see. We have a Kenya right now at Pour that was a limited, they call it a micro lot. It was a small crop that was grown, and it is just tasting phenomenal. So we bought some of those. We also, actually kind of in honor of the film, we brought in two coffees, one from Rwanda and one from Honduras. Those are the two regions that the film focused on. So we thought it'd be nice to have those this coming weekend, during the release of the film. So any customer could come in and try that.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think it's interesting that in the wine industry, there's obviously tastings, tasting rooms, et cetera. I've heard the term cuppings in coffee, though. I don't know if there are routinely publicly available cuppings, or if people are curious about that, what's a cupping like?
There are. Actually, Joe Bean has a lab that they do public cuppings regularly. We're also going to be doing some, actually, this kind of after we get through this event, the film about coffee on Sunday, the 27th, we're going to be getting into more cuppings. And that's basically, it's kind of one of those things where you can set a cup of coffee side by side with another one. And when you do that, you can taste differences. You wouldn't think that you could just, coffee tastes like coffee. But when you have a cup of coffee from, Honduras sitting next to something from Colombia, you can taste different things, little notes and flavor notes that you wouldn't think you could pick out. And when you do line them up side by side, there's definite differences that come through.
All right, John, tell us one more time. The film is on Sunday. Tell us real briefly about the film.
Yeah, so the film, it's connecting the human element of coffee growing to getting it in your cup at a coffee shop or roasting or brewing it at home. It's going to be at the Little Theater, 240 East Ave, on July 27th. The doors open at 6 p.m., and the film starts screening at 6:30. We expect to sell out, so you can get your tickets right at the Little on their website, or you could go down to the theater itself and grab them there.
And what are you doing afterward?
We're going to have there's going to be a Q&A with some of the coffee shops in Rochester. So if you have questions on the film or just how this industry is growing and expanding, we're going to do that. And then we're going to have a get-together happy hour / some coffee brewing after the film, which we'll let everyone know where it is at that day.
My thanks to John Ebel of Pour Coffee in Rochester. We're coming right back with a conversation about great bread. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, it's a cheese roundtable. The Finger Lakes Cheese Festival is this weekend, and we'll hear from a group of cheesemakers who have finally established their own cheese trail, much like the Finger Lakes Wine Trail. And we'll go inside a new study on the health benefits of organic food. Is it worth paying more for organic? That's Wednesday on The Next Connections.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Being short isn't all bad. You can save money by buying clothes made for children.
Yeah, it's definitely a little rush, a little bit of glee knowing that you're kind of gaming the system a little bit. It makes up for having to use a stool to get stuff in the kitchen. It's one little victory for short people.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Short people are just the same.
This afternoon at 2.
We close this hour with a look at bread. Specifically, the Boston Globe reports that high-end restaurants on the East Coast have a new trend. No free bread. Now, it's not fair to say that every restaurant in Boston is no longer offering free bread, but certainly there is a growing trend, and there seem to be two reasons. Cost savings and the growing population of diners who want food that is gluten-free. We wanted to find out if Rochester's restaurant scene is undergoing a similar change, so I invited Brian Antonor to join me. Brian is a chef with experience at some of Rochester's most popular spots, including Rio Bamba and others. Brian, you are an easy choice for this interview because I think you happen to make the best bread in Rochester. Now, everyone has a different opinion on that, but clearly you put a lot of thought into it. So let's start with whether we're seeing in Rochester what the Boston Globe is reporting. Sometimes people say Rochester is slow to follow trends or a little bit behind the bigger cities, et cetera. The Boston Globe is saying that the traditional complimentary bread basket at higher-end restaurants is disappearing for two reasons. The economy, obviously you're giving away food, it costs something, and the anti-wheat movement. They called it a juggernaut. Not just celiac, which is roughly 1% by some estimates, but also some people who choose to be gluten-free. So let me just start with this. Are we seeing in Rochester any of those trends when it comes to the bread basket disappearing?
There's been, since 9/11 is really when I'm going to say I first noticed. That's when the economic turndown really came in Rochester, in the local market. You would see upscale restaurants now starting to, I'm going to say, start outsourcing and start looking to find a bakery or someone to work with them because of economic reasons. The restaurants started to tail back on their staff and start running kitchens bare bones because we just weren't having the turnout that we were having before. And I'm going to say, diners started coming out less frequently and we were experiencing definitely a downturn.
So that really started closer to 9/11. It's not maybe something that you saw in the last 12 months, 2 years with celiac, et cetera.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The non-gluten is definitely in the forefront now. You it seems like from a chef's perspective, when a table comes into the restaurant, it seems like more and more tables now are having more dietary restrictions and having a little more special requests when it comes to the food. And as a restaurant, of course, we want to be hospitable and cater to everybody. So we feel like we have to be on our game and be able to cater to everyone's needs, not only with the gluten, but I feel like carbs have just had a bad rep in general for the last few years. I can remember back when the South Beach diet and the Atkins diet were very popular. And I wouldn't be surprised if when the Atkins diet came out that it maybe even closed the door to some of the smaller, I'm going to say, mom-and-pop style bakeries in town.
I recall talking to John Vito, who used to run Obagolo's before he got sick, actually, and had to close it on State Street. Made fabulous sandwiches, and I remember 10 years, he said, this is the most ridiculous trend in the world, this notion of don't ever eat bread again, and all of a sudden your life magically gets better. He said, certainly moderation's a good thing. He said, but look at some of the healthiest people in the world in Europe eat bread every day. And it looked to me like that was more of a 2 to 3, maybe a 5-year trend. And I don't see Atkins or South Beach as much. I'm not saying I never see it. But hopefully you see less of an impact now than the sort of the apocalyptic stuff we heard 10 years ago in the food industry.
It's not in your face so much anymore. However, now with celiac really taking more of a forefront, it seems like even those who can have gluten, can eat bread, can eat pastas, they choose not to. And I feel like now when diners come in, it's easier for them to say, well, I can't have gluten. Not because of any sort of health restrictions. It's just they just choose not to.
Right.
Yeah.
They think there's certainly a segment of the population that thinks gluten-free is sort of like a health trend. But we've talked to nutritionists for this show, and they say, you know, if you're not diagnosed with celiac, going entirely gluten-free might actually have ill effects. So that's just something to keep in mind. Now, let's just talk a little bit about one of my favorite restaurant subjects, which is bread, because I think I go to a lot of places, and if the bread is sort of a throwaway, I not only don't eat it, but I feel like it's maybe a red flag that the folks in the kitchen aren't as attentive to detail on all the things. And so maybe I'm overanalyzing the bread, but again, I should say that's one of the reasons I invited Chef Brian Antonor in, because when I eat your food, you always start it with bread that is outrageously good. So what's your perspective on the value of bread?
Yeah, Evan, I'm with you. I feel like bread is the first—it's the first thing to hit the table, and it really sets the stage. I mean, when you can make that first impression, you want to still have that wow factor and kind of put across to the diner that every point in the meal is important, just as important. The main course is no important than the bread basket that's hitting the table. I think what you see now is over the years, like I was saying before, with restaurants kind of operating with less people in the back in the kitchen. For the last few years now, I feel like chefs now are putting on so many hats back there now. I really can't remember working in a small privately owned freestanding restaurant that employs a pastry chef anymore. It's just something that restaurants just can't afford to do. And now a lot of the chefs kind of have to prioritize, I'm going to say, you know, their daily workload. And it's very easy to outsource those products now to develop a relationship with a bakery and have them start and make, a great bread that lives up to your expectations, that's going to live up to your diner's expectations. One thing that I see is over the years, the amount of bakeries have just diminished over the years. So now in a market like Rochester, you don't have a lot of choices, and it seems like the ones that are the bakeries that are doing a great job, and they've positioned themselves to really kind of stand out from everybody else. Going into a finer dining restaurant, it seems like they're all kind of working together, and a lot of times you'll see the same, I'm going to say, bread basket from restaurant to restaurant because they're using the same baker, which is great that they're focused in on the quality and they want to provide a great bread basket. However, they haven't taken that opportunity to separate themselves in the market from other restaurants, because you see the bread basket kind of looking the same, and then you've got the expense on it, where when you have a baker, when you have a pastry shop on site, let's just say you're going to have a slow service, you can prepare for that. When you're working with a bakery, you kind of have a standing order, and you have to kind of forecast what's happening before it even happens. So if you're having a slow service and at the end of service you have some loaves of bread left over, now you're looking at some waste factor here. Or chefs have to get creative and find a way to use leftover bread. The skill sets too. I find running my own kitchen that it seems like there's a lot of shortage of cooks, chefs out there that really understand baking and have the training and know how to put together a great loaf of bread. So for a chef that has those skills and I'm going to say even a restaurant that is set up to produce bread, a lot of restaurants now, they're not even set up for it. They couldn't produce bread even if they wanted to. They don't have a mixer large enough to mix a good sized dough to accommodate for the bread load that you'll need for the service for the day, and having the right oven. A lot of restaurants now, when they're designing even new restaurants, these important pieces of equipment that you need to make great bread, they're not even equipping the restaurant with these pieces now because they're going to outsource the product,
yeah.
and so they don't even need to spend the money up front to set themselves up to make bread.
My guest is Brian Antonor, one of the great chefs in Rochester, who is, whether you know it or not, he's been at a lot of the best chefs end up at a number of places, and so you might have had his bread at several places around town. And his wife, by the way, is going to be on this program soon enough. She writes some food reviews for the Democrat and Chronicle and for some other places, and so his wife's going to be helping review some of the hot food places and around the Rochester Finger Lakes region. So with that being said, I have to ask Brian, when you're out to dinner with your wife, on account of the fact that maybe you actually never do get out to dinner with young children and your work, but if you do get out to dinner with your wife, what makes a great basket of bread in your eyes, and do you think she would agree?
You know, believe it or not, we get out more often than you would think.
Good for you.
Yeah. We do. We really enjoy going out. You know, and we do have little ones, and a lot of times we'll just bring the little ones with us, so we don't let them slow us down for going out.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, a great bread basket to me is when you know it's made in house. I mean, you can feel that the kitchen, the chef, they've put their heart and soul into it. I guess I'm going to say picky eater. I like fresh, hot, right on the spot. You know it's baked fresh that day. It's coming out warm. When you crack it open, there's still a little steam coming out of it, and the butter melts really easily into it. And yeah, I mean, bread is, think about what it takes to make a loaf of bread. It's pretty simple. It's just, four ingredients. And when you can create that balance and get those four ingredients right, simple as working with your standard white flour and then getting, introducing whole wheats and seeds and olives and cheeses. I mean, there's so much that chefs are putting in breads these days. I guess I'm more of a simple taste. I like something that's a little more simple and a little more traditional. Would
your wife agree with all of this?
You really put me on the spot here.
You have to speak for her.
I'm going to say yes, yes. I'm going to, maybe I should plead the fifth on this.
Well, she'll be on this program, so we'll play this audio back and see if she does agree with your take on it. Before we let Chef Brian Antonor go, it's a couple more quick questions on this and then one other subject. First of all, can you see a future where high-end dining no longer offers a free bread basket?
Not at the high end, no. I don't see it. The bread basket is something that's very traditional. It's most of the higher-end places have the means, the knowledge, the ability to do it, and I don't think it's part of going out to a high-end restaurant. When you put on that jacket and you straighten up that tie, I mean, you want everything that comes with it.
Are you saying people still dress up when they go out to eat?
Dress code has changed, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, you said at a high end, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, get in the dress. Most diners, the jack and the tie is really becoming a thing in the past as well. But I don't see the bread basket not being at the table like you don't see ties and jackets anymore.
Before we let you go, then, on some of the other trends here, we hear a lot of buzz about organic. On Wednesday on this program, we're going to be talking about whether organic meats. The studies show whether it meets the health values that people hope when they're paying a premium for it in the grocery store, for example. But is that part of what your customers are asking for or asking about more often than they used to in the last, say, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, most definitely. I feel that diners nowadays they're definitely more educated. They're going to come into the restaurants armed now, if you will. It's important for them to know where their food's coming from, where the restaurant, where their food sources are from. I hear the questions all the time. You know, where is this oyster coming from? Where is this fish being fished? Is it farm raised? Is it wild? Same in the beef market. Is it organic? Is it grass fed? Is it local? Is it they know the right questions to ask.
Are the cows happy?
That's, you know, they don't usually ask that question. Is it important? Yeah, I feel like it's a very small percentage. I feel like for the most part, people go out to eat and they go out to enjoy food, and they, I'm going to say, they put a lot of trust into the restaurants they go to. And I feel like when you kind of do your research a little bit about the establishment, more so the products, when you feel that you understand the background of the restaurant operators and the chefs, and you understand the quality of the products that they bring in, then I feel like for the most part diners have a sense of security with going out to eat at the higher end places, but it's definitely important. It's definitely something that people are they want to know where their food's coming from, and it's I'm going to say it's becoming more of a lifestyle change here in Rochester.
Last question for you. You and your wife have a night out, no kids. You can go out to eat at any restaurant that you have yet to go to, either in Rochester or anywhere in the country, with no budget. What's on the top of your list that you would excite you to go to? Again, no budget, money's no option. Where are you going to dinner?
Yeah, I think that's an easy question. I'm going to Alinea. I like to go to Chicago and go to Grant Atch's restaurant, Alinea.
And why is that?
For a number of reasons. I want to sit down and have a great 20-course meal. The idea of having smaller portions, the tasty menu, it's definitely a style in which I enjoy eating. I like little bites of food. I like the element of surprise. He's really, I'm going to say, he's on top of the game in terms of the U.S. in molecular gastronomy. I like that element of surprise when you're eating.
My thanks to Brian Antonor, and of course, my thanks to you for listening. Also, our thanks to our engineer for the hour, Dave Campo, the man behind the glass. It's been a great Tuesday afternoon. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. I'm Evan Dawson. This is member-supported public radio.